Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us today. Bill Arnold in for Neil Stavem, who is on a wonderful vacation in Colorado, as far as we know. We don't know that for sure, but we think that's where he is.
He's having a wonderful time.
Yeah, and that's Ted Ross on the board. And Carissa is in the phone room, and we're going to probably be taking lots of calls today. We're going to talk about parenting, and we're going to talk about intentional parenting, 10 ways to be an exceptional parent in a quick fix world. That's a book written by Doug and Kathy Fields. Doug is going to be our guest on the show today, time permitting, because you know what happens, Ted, I get talking,
yeah,
and you know how interesting I can be, and then
sure.
The next thing you know, the whole hour's filled up, and the guest never got on.
And you have 2 minutes, yeah.
Exactly. So, while I was coming into the studio today, I ran into Susie Larson, the amazing, the one and only, the always great, never less than sensational Susie Larson.
Love her.
Love her, as we all do. And it dawned on me, as I was listening to her on the radio, I think it was this morning, on Dr. Bill Meyer Live, that she is not only a deep and beautiful well of wisdom and talent, but she is the same person on the air as she is off the air.
So true. Absolutely.
That is so true. Whereas I'm a total phony on the air. And off the air, I'm somewhat genuine, right?
You're genuine, yeah. I think you're not giving yourself enough credit that you are authentic.
Well, anyway, but that's what happens when you come into the studio and you pass people as you're coming, they're going, and you just get a chance to say hi and chat for a little bit.
You know who they are.
Yeah.
Susie prayed for us today in our staff meeting. Which
see what I mean?
I always love.
She is the same person on the air as she is off, and that I appreciate because what you see is what you get, and that's really refreshing.
That's really important for our topic today, too, in parenting. I mean, kids can spot hypocrisy
just
like
that. Yes,
they can. So you have to actually back up and live what you're saying and trying to teach them.
Yeah. So Doug Fields, I met, I don't know, 30 years ago, and he has written over 60 books, which makes me think, was he bullied as a kid? And I will just get back at all the people that bullied me by writing 60 books, because I've not read 60 books in my life.
Right. He's kicked out 60 himself.
He's written 60, and he's been involved in youth ministry for quite a while. He's been working at Saddleback Church. I think you've heard of that.
Yeah, Rick Warren. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And he's co-founder of DownloadYouthMinistry.com, and he's the director of Homeward Center for the Youth and Family at Azusa Pacific University. His wife, Kathy, they speak all over on marriage and parenting. And if you want more information about our guest today, you can go to DougFields.com. And I think talking to me for a whole hour will constitute some sort of community service for Doug. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill. No, yeah. I'm actually so far listening to you, it feels like community service. So I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah. So I have to plead a little bit of the fifth today, Doug, because I don't have children. But our producer, Ted, does, and we were talking about your book, which is, you know, talking about something that's very accessible, something that is easy to pick up, it's easy to go through, it's loaded with good information. And we were talking about adolescence, because Ted's got two girls in that stage, and he says the advice you often get is you have to, what is it, Ted?
Well, you often hear people say, we just got to get through this
get
stage.
Get through it,
right?
Yeah. So as a dad who's got two kids, obviously we don't want that phase of life to just be over with. Give us some opening encouragement as to how to survive that and even thrive during that time.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, Ted, what I love about Bill is he can be an expert because he doesn't have kids,
yeah, right?
Exactly.
I tell people all the time, I say, I was a total expert on parenting until I became one. And then when my kids became teenagers, I became the dumbest human on the planet, and now that they're all, you know, in their 20s, I'm back to being kind of semi-cool. But, Bill, you can play the expert role not being a parent, so that's great.
Yeah.
No, you know, there is something, as cliche as it sounds, there is really something about survival. But it's less about survival in that that phase will end. I actually talked to two parents last night, a blended family. They both had 14-year-olds when they got together, and the parents were referring to them as pistols. So I felt like I was actually talking to my mom at that point, because I haven't heard that word in such a long time. Maybe that's a Minnesota phrase. I'm not sure. That
it might be.
Pistols. Yeah. But, you know, now it's 10 years later, and they were talking about how, you know, what wonderful young women they are and how wonderful it has been and things like that. But so there actually is a reality of kind of this change that happens in a teenager's, you know, body in terms of their physical change, their emotional changes. Their mind is thinking from more concrete to abstract. They just become weird. I was teasing these parents last night and said, did you think they were demon-possessed? Because that's actually what they thought. But here's where I think parents make a problem, make it more of a problem, is they actually disengage during this time. And that's when teenagers – Ted, I don't know how old your kids are. But,
yeah, 15 and 13.
Yeah, and so this is the time where, you know, because if you want to be mad as a dad – you could be mad 24/7 with a 15 and 13-year-old, but a lot of times what parents do is they'll disengage during this season of life. They'll kind of go pouty or moody, or, you know, if I would give them one of our 10 ways that we talk about in the book, like the words of affirmation, and parents say, well, if they don't affirm or encourage me, I'm not going to encourage them. And, you know, that's kind of when I want to go, you know, UFC on parents and punch, but I don't. But, mm-hmm. You know, that's when you say, hey, you need to be the adult in this situation. And I think that's part of that whole survival mentality, is parents actually being the adult, being the parent, knowing that this is a season, this is a phase. They were adolescents once. They probably don't remember how awkward and weird they were. But don't disengage. Don't be passive-aggressive. This is when, you know, I say to parents of teenagers, this is when you need to pour it on even more. Mm. Even though your kids are going to give you the impression they don't want anything to do with you.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, Intentional Parenting, 10 Ways to Become an Exceptional Parent, I want to actually talk about some of these points because we have a whole hour to plow through here. So let's talk about what intentional parents believe. One of the things they believe is they do have an incredible influence on their kids. Say more about that.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, for us, we say one of the key of the 10 is what we call strong belief. And this isn't strong belief like, you know, oh, Jill, you're a beautiful singer. You should be on American Idol. You know, yes, believe in your kids, believe they're talented, believe they're gifted. But it's not believing in your kids. It's actually believing, Bill, in your role as a parent. And because if you don't believe that you're the most influential person in the life of your child, you actually kind of sabotage your best efforts, and, you know, you become really nothing more than kind of a shift manager, your own bed and breakfast. So this strong belief is, you know, I see parents' eyes kind of roll back. And this is whether I'm talking to Christian parents or non-Christian parents, is that when I say you are the most important person in their life, well, you know, maybe like Ted, if you've got a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old, you don't feel like you're the most important person. But all social science points to that. You know, all research done on parenting points to the fact that you're the most influential person. And when you stop acting like that, for whatever reason, you're either too busy, you're passive-aggressive, you don't think your kids want you involved in their lives, what you do then is then you transfer that that value from you to culture and peers and media and that type of thing. So that's when kids get influenced by those other influences, when parents either consciously or subconsciously disengage. So, yeah, that strong belief is a big one.
Mm-hmm. Doug, seeing as how we're still going to stay on adolescence for just a minute here, let's talk about the difference between adolescent boys and adolescent girls. Talk about what's unique to each gender.
Well, you know, I mean, I think less and less, you know, kids are actually fitting in stereotypes. Mm-hmm. I think today's kids are breaking stereotypes that even I had 10 years ago of them. I think because of, you know, exposure to things at different ages and earlier. And, I mean, we all know all the conversation right now about gender confusion, mm-hmm. that type of thing. But, you know, differences is girls are going to be much, much moodier. They're going to play to what in the teenage world of what I say is called an imaginary audience. that they always think everybody is watching everything they do. So you go to a high school football game and a girl's going up the steps and she, you know, barely trips a little bit on a step and she sit down and start crying.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, what, you know, what's wrong? Everyone saw that. Well, no one saw it, you know, but
yeah.
She actually thinks the whole stadium was watching her.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that tends to be a little more female than a little more guy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think a lot of, in terms of a lot of the emotional needs that teenagers have between male and female is very, very similar. You know, they need attention, they need belief, they need affection, you know, they need empowerment. They need a caring adult to actually think they have something to offer. They're not just excess baggage. So, you know, I'm not really an expert on differences.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really not an expert on anything.
Yeah. Welcome to my world.
Yeah.
But one of the things you said about adolescence is as they start to flex their independence a little bit and pull back a little bit with affection, the parent needs to step in and making sure they're offering almost more affection at that time. Did I say that right?
Yeah, yeah. And affection is one of the 10. You know, when I'm talking to men, I call it ongoing affection because men tend to be so literal that, you know, they just go home and hug their kid once and check it off and go, okay, so, you know, what's next?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's the ongoing. And as I mentioned earlier about the pour it on, especially during adolescence, because kids don't have the emotional vocabulary to say that they actually need their skin hunger fed. So, for example, we just have we're real involved with a birth of a preemie, 12-month-old preemie baby, or 12-week preemie. And this preemie, as soon as the baby was born in tubes and they saw that the baby was going to survive, they immediately put, her name is Farah, they put Farah on mom's skin. And not just mom's skin. What was interesting to me is the doctors had the dad take his shirt off, and he sat and laid in bed and had the baby on his skin as well. Now, mm-hmm. Where am I going with this? This whole idea that we've heard about people are born with skin hunger and that skin hunger needs to be fed, you know, for me, it was such a graphic illustration of what I've been talking about with kids needing affection that, you know, here's medical, you know, science is saying that baby needs to be on skin right now.
Mm.
And it was amazing to me. It just kind of opened up a whole new world of skin hunger for me because you think about kids, you know, Ted, when your kids were born, are they both girls?
Yeah, two girls. Yep.
Yeah. So when your girls were born, everybody's picking them up and playing with them and, you know, holding them and throwing them in the air and doing all that stuff. But as they get a little bit older, especially where they are now with 13 and 15, you know, they're not getting much skin hunger fed at all. And what happens, especially with girls, if they're not getting appropriate skin hunger fed by males in their life, i.e. dad, uncle, grandpa, significant men in their life, you know, those girls are going to go find that skin hunger fed by someone else. And, you know, we all know we live in a culture that there's plenty of people that are ready to, you know, to provide that feeding, you know, in regard. So, yeah, when it comes to adolescents, you know, they don't have the emotional vocabulary to say, you know, dad, I need you to hug me. Mom, I need you to hug me. Even though I'm giving you every nonverbal in the world, but I don't even want to be around you, I actually need you to hug me. So what I do is I tell parents who have young kids, you know, sometimes when you're just starting being an intentional parent with teenagers, the journey is a little more difficult. When you have younger kids, it's a little easier because you're picking a path. And to say, you know what, we're going to be a house of huggers. So we're going to hug in the morning. We're going to hug before meals. We're going to hug before you go to bed. When they're little, that's no big deal. But if they grow up in that environment, all of a sudden they hit adolescence where it's not as cool to hug your parents anymore. They know that's part of the gig. That's who we are as a family, and that's what we do. Now, we might do it behind closed doors. And, Dad, I don't want you to hug me in the school parking lot when you drop me off. I don't even want you to drop me off in the school parking lot, Dad. I want you to drop me off a mile away, and I'll walk. You know, so that's when we pour it on.
Yeah. We're talking to Doug Fields. He's written a book called Intentional Parenting. If you have a question for him, give us a call, 1-877-933-2484. When we come back, we're going to talk about children learn from observing you. You are their primary role model. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Bill Arnold in for Neil Staben. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Theodore?
Yes.
It is?
Actually applies.
That's why I said it.
Very good.
You and Ward wash up. No, you and Wally wash up and come to dinner. You know, I realize I'm becoming more like Ward than I am Wally.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Just because you're getting older?
Yeah, because I'm getting older.
Yeah.
I get a pair of slippers for Christmas, and I go, I like these a lot.
And you mean it.
And I mean it, yeah. Yeah. We're talking to Doug Fields. He's written a book called Intentional Parenting. That's the one we're talking about today. However, he has 60 books he's written in his catalog, so he has a wealth of information. And one of the things that scares parents more than anything is the whole idea that their children are going to learn from observing them. They are going to be their primary role models. So the whole idea that, at one point we're watching them and then it gets turned and they're watching us. Doug, say more about that.
Well, I think the reason we put that in the book is because we wanted parents to realize that really their life is under surveillance 24/7, that they're watching everything. And you said it right. You know, when they're little, they're trying to get your attention. You know, my son was always like, Dad, watch me, Dad, watch me, Dad, watch. As he'd, you know, do something, he'd jump down one stairs or something like that. But they subtly make a shift and they start watching. They start watching parents, you know, how they talk to one another, how they talk to strangers, what they watch on television, how much they drink, how they drive, their cell phone use, their giving, generosity. I mean, they're just always watching. You know, but one of the things we didn't talk about that Kathy and I actually put in the very beginning of the book is we let parents know that the clock is running in terms of their time. You know, your child from 0 to 18 makes up approximately 936 weeks. That's really all you have between 0 and 16, and it's 936 weeks, and it seems like a long time when your kid is, you know, in diapers, but they get to the teenage years where Ted is at right now, and you blink, and, you know, you're at your kid's graduation, and you go, where did those 936 weeks go? And those 936 weeks really are a classroom education where they're observing the professor, mom and dad, mm-hmm. and taking everything in. So just reminding parents, you know, I can remember my parents saying, don't do as I do, you know, do as I say. Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't fly anymore. You know, that's just too, especially when a kid begins to think a little more abstractly, that just comes off as weak and hypocritical and it doesn't, you know, doesn't hold value. So yeah, role model is a big one. So a lot of parenting is not just what actions do I do to my kids. A lot of parenting is actually what I would call holding up the mirror and looking within, saying, what kind of man am I? You know, what kind of woman, you know, what am I, if I can't say good words, well, that's got to be a reflection of my heart. That's what Jesus said. You know, mm-hmm. that's not my wisdom. I just stole that. You know, if we can't articulate good words, we've got a heart problem. So we got to hold up the mirror and say, what is it about me that's broken that I need to change, I need to work on as a parent before I inflict, you know, many dollars of therapy on my kids who, you know, they're paying for the therapy that I should have got.
Mm-hmm. And Doug, when I was looking at the list of things in your book, children are watching that, like you say, there. It's a surveillance camera. So it's how you think, how you pray, how you talk about those who are hurting. How do you deal with your finances? How do you make decisions? How do you deal with pain? What you watch on TV, what, why, and how often you eat. I mean, they're tracking everything you do. And so you got to be aware that they're a super sponge, and everything that you show them is getting sucked in at some level.
Yep, absolutely. And you're just always on. And that's a rough reality for parents. You know, Ted, I don't know if you talk to that, but when you think that you're always being watched, when, you know, how you handle a situation is just being recorded, because that comes into family history, then your kids take that into the merging of their future relationships. I mean, so much is riding on these 936 weeks, and many of us come into parenting without a plan. And that's kind of the, you know, the theme or the thesis of intentional parenting is just kind of have, just think of the end game. You know, we do that in the marketplace. Anybody who's got business or, you know, people know when they're going to sell their business or kind of what the goal is for their business. Or even when you join a committee or in Little League or Girl Scouts, you kind of have an end game. Hey, I'm going to do this. I'll be done in 2 years or whatever. But in parenting, we don't rarely ever do that. We don't have an end game. We don't think about at the end of 936 weeks, what do I want my kid to look like? Not physically, but, you know, emotionally, spiritually, and articulate that end game. And then what we do is we parent toward that end game. So if one of the things we want our kids to do is express compassion, then we've got to model that. We've got to put them in situations where we're, you know, taking them to, you know, impoverished areas in our communities, visiting nursing homes to care for the elderly, whatever it is. We can't just say, I want my kid to be compassionate, and then us, one, not model it, and two, not give them opportunities to express that.
Mm-hmm. Doug, I have an end game to still have a job at the end of this hour, so don't mess this up for me.
All right, you got
okay,
it.
Awesome.
You got it. And so, see, you know what? That's a short-term goal.
I know. I appreciate that. One of the things in your book that really resonated with me, because I've heard this time and time again from parents, is there's this whole idea that you get into a habit of saying things about your kid. You know, she's a chip off the old block. You know, he's the flip side of the same coin. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You know, there's those expressions that if a kid hears enough time, he or she might start living that out, which may not be the best thing for the kid. Fair?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely fair. You know, I think when we get to, you know, and, you know, maybe we could even use that as an opportunity to transition to one of the other 10 that
sure.
Kathy and I talk about, and that's encouraging words, because the words that we use actually have the ability to shape a kid's life. And people kind of disagree with me on this at first, and then I say, you trust me, when you get to heaven, you'll see I was right and you were wrong on this one. But your words actually can shape a kid's life. So, Bill, you've probably had somebody say, you know, this is my daughter Jill. She's shy.
Right.
As Jill cowers behind mom's legs.
Right.
You know, and because she's heard that modifier a million times. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, this is my wild son Carlos is, you know, Carlos lets out an evil laugh and lights a palm tree on fire because he's heard that descriptor so often.
Yeah.
So when we say things like, you know, like father, like son, or chip off the old block, or mm-hmm. shy, or we add that modifier,
mm-hmm.
we're just reinforcing, you know, negative images or image. You know, it's like anything. You want to flip the other side of that coin, say, you actually affirm what you want to see in your kid's life. So
mm-hmm.
if you want them to be compassionate, you know, sweetheart, it was so great how you you served mom when she was laying on the couch not feeling good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever. You use those words to affirm what you actually want to see in your end game.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I actually tweeted something the other day that got a lot of action. And I didn't intend it to, but it was something to like, why are we as parents and leaders so frugal with our words?
Yeah.
You know, we hold them back like they're, you know, they're
true.
We're going to get some savings account for them. Or
yeah.
if we don't use good words, we're going to be rich.
I got to hold you back right now, Doug. We have to go. We have a hard break coming up here. When we come back, we're going to talk lots more with Doug Fields about his book, Intentional Parenting. Give us a call, 1-877-933-2484 with questions or comments. Listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Thanks for being with us on Connecting Faith today. I hope your lunch hour is going good. This is Bill Arnold in for Neil Staven. We're talking to Doug Fields today. He's written a zillion books. This one we're talking about today is Intentional Parenting. And, Doug, I have a question for you. As you deal with your kids, is there a difference between compliance and obedience? And is it okay to say, because I said so?
Well, I think there's a big difference, Bill, between compliance and, you know, obedience. I mean, compliance is what I would call, I refer to that as quick fix parenting. You know, quick fix parenting is a little bit of, you know, sit down, shut up, knock it off, stop, do it. You know, you get the behavior stopped,
mm-hmm.
but it it isn't, you know, it, I don't think those have long-term benefits. Typically, that's I think parents create that kind of response when they get them to stop. It really is for the parent. So it's going to make my life easier if you stop. But, you know, discipline is a little bit more, you know, guidance with love. And so, you know, when we discipline for compliance, it's usually to make our life better.
Mm-hmm.
But when we discipline with guidance, it's, you know, what I would call it. That's what I refer to as intentional parenting. It makes the child's life long term better.
Mm-hmm. What about when parents just get so frustrated with their kids? And you've got an illustration here in your book. You said you've heard parents say, "He never says anything nice to me, so I'm just going to give him his own treatment." Is that productive?
Yeah. Well, that's what I was mentioning a little bit earlier about we have to, as parents, we actually have to be the adults.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's when we have to, you know, that's when parents just have to go, you know what, I'm the adult. This is the child. I can't respond in a childish way. They don't have the emotional vocabulary to care for me in this moment right now. They don't understand the big picture. You know, they don't understand how much I love them. You know, I've got to give them what they need, and that's going to be, you know, whatever, words of affirmation, effective discipline, you know, affection, whatever it is.
Doug, what happens if kids are friends with kids whose parents are maybe not good parents? I mean, they let their kids get away with too much, or they even enable them, like hosting parties at their house, and your friends and your kids go, "Hey, these friends are cool," and you're sitting there thinking, "Ooh, no, they're not. I don't want my kids around those kids."
Yeah. Well, that's a very difficult situation. Those are never fun times when you're a parent, but those are the conversations, you know, those are the teachable moments. Those are the times where you're, you know, going, I'm sorry, sweetheart, that we're your parents and they're not, but because we are your parents and we're to love you in the way that God has inspired us to love you. That behavior isn't going to be a part of our family system. So I'm sorry you can't go to that, or I'm sorry that you feel like we're terrible parents. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's going to be, it doesn't matter. You know, the thing about parenting, it doesn't matter how rational you are. It doesn't, you know, like I do this thing on talk about discipline and responsibility. And, you know, I say that a lot of times, you know, good discipline is when you don't catch kids off guard, when they actually know what the consequence is going to be. And it's articulated ahead of time, and so they're not caught off guard with that consequence. So whether it's, you know, curfew or toys or whatever, they know that if I do this, this is the result. And when that happens, when it's clearly communicated, what happens, it's me and my child against the consequence.
Hmm.
And this, you know, this is a little bit, I wish I had a visual aid on this, but radio doesn't help this way. But, you know, so typically parenting is me against my child when it comes to discipline, okay? But if it's clearly defined ahead of time what the consequence is going to be, then it can actually be me and my child against the consequence. But no matter how well you enforce that consequence, so, if I'm in Ted's shoes right now and I've got that 15-year-old and we've got curfew going on, and the daughter knows that if I'm late, then that means the consequence is 3 weeks in during the weekends. Even as clearly as it's communicated, even so I can meet her at the door being calm, I don't have to yell, I don't have to posture, I don't have to shame her.
Mm-hmm.
All I have to do now is enforce the consequence that we already talked about. No matter how well you do that as a parent, your child is never going to go, "You know, Dad, you're really good. Thank you for being so caring and calm."
Mm-hmm.
And you, yes, Dad, you did articulate those consequences ahead of time, and I knew full well, and I shouldn't be mad at you. I should just be mad at myself because I made a bad choice. So I humbly submit to these consequences. You know, they're never going to do that. No matter how well you parent, they're always going to roll their eyes or think you're an idiot or you're a bad parent. And so that's just, that is part of, you know, I tell parents, if you can't enforce discipline, if you can't say, going back to your original question, Bill, if you can't say, you know, I'm sorry, sweetheart, that you can't go to that party, and they just have different parenting values that we have, if you can't do that, you're never going to be an effective parent.
Mm-hmm.
Because your job is not to make them your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Your job is to parent them in a way that you will be friends with them.
Yeah. Doug, we have a very intentional parent on the line right now that has a question for you. Her name is Jennifer. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You have a question for Doug? Go right ahead.
Yeah, I do. Very interesting topic, really resonated with me. I have an older son in high school, and I have three younger daughters as well. And as a mom, I find it very easy to relate to my girls. We're able to go to a lot of activities together, and we're a pretty huggy, loving family. And with my son, I find it's hit or miss with the affection now that he's older. And my question is just, how do I be more intentional? Because he's so, sometimes he's very much wanting the affection, wanting the hugs. Other times it's just, hi, mom, bye, mom. And it's hit or miss. So how do I, it's so easy with my girls. It's so much harder with my son. And I am looking for ways and opportunities to connect with him as well. And that's so important to me, especially given that he's in high school and not as much time left with him at home.
Great question, Doug.
Yeah, it is a great question. Well, I actually think, you know, just even hearing you ask that question, I think you know the answer to it, because it's not as easy with him as it is with your girls. So, you know, anything that's not as easy, it needs more intention, needs more effort, needs more focus. So I would even go as simple as, you know, I'm typically used to talking to men who need specific guidelines. So, you know, I'll say, put it in your calendar, set an alarm that it goes off. Every time it goes off, go hug your child. You know, whatever it is I'd go, okay, I've only got him, he's in high school. I've only got him in the morning. So when he's making breakfast, even if it's mom, I'm coming up behind him and giving him a hug from behind and telling him you love him. He's not asking for it. He's not hugging you back. He's not looking for it. You know, he's watching TV. You go sit next to him and wrap your leg around his and say, you know, what are we watching? So there may be some times where he gets up or scoots over, like, mom, you're sitting too close. That's weird. That's okay. That's going to happen. You keep pouring it on. You keep looking for those opportunities. You know, you're going into his room when you know he's already in bed or about to be asleep, and, you know, you sit on his bed and just tell him that you love him, and you just wanted to say that to him before he went to bed. Because, you know, if he's in high school, I mean, you think about it. Your 936 weeks are way down. You're depending on what year he is, you know, you're in the, you know, 80s to hundreds of weeks left, and those, you blink and they're done. So I think by just what I love in your question is the awareness that it's not easy and it requires something more for you. And so, you know, maybe it's even as simple as every time it feels natural for you to do something with your girls, you go, okay, it's payback time. You know, you don't say that out loud or to your son, but you just go, okay, I got to go find him, or I'm going to text him words of affirmation. I mean, I'm guessing if he's a high school student in American culture, he probably has a phone. And, you know, when you think how easy it is with your daughters, you know, text him something. That is, it's not the same as physical affection, but words of affirmation are important for a teenager's soul.
Jennifer, great question.
Really, honestly,
go ahead.
Yeah, just to quickly sum up that is exactly what I do. I'm always just looking for opportunities, and I do give him hugs, and I do send him texts, and good job, and hope things go well. I do. But the thing that's so funny is I feel like when you commented on that, we're the most important role model. I feel like I do all that, but I don't feel like I'm seeing that it matters to him. I'm sure it does in his heart because he's a good kid. But I feel like, I, you know, the response, but then again, you know what? Every once in a while, he'll completely surprise me and come up with tons of hugs. So yeah, just not necessarily seeing the reciprocation, but not all the time, but I do see it periodically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got to. You almost have to imagine it like it's a black hole, and you're throwing something in that bucket, and you look in the bucket and you go, man, it doesn't seem like it's going anywhere. There's nothing. This bucket is not filling up, and you have to. I've talked about that. Maybe said it three times already on the show. You can't disengage during that time, which I love that it sounds like you're not doing, but he just doesn't have the emotional vocabulary to sit you down and say, mom, I see your efforts and I thank you for it. And, you know, he's just not, but he will, you know, my kids are 27, 24, and 21, and they're just now beginning to, their words are more articulate. They're more affectionate back. They're actually humans now. And, you know, and you're going to, you know, your blessing is coming, kind of like we talked about early in the show, is you just have to hold on a little bit, but don't give up. And I promise you, you're going to see rewards, especially for those kids that are more difficult. You know, your girls may actually go through a difficult stage too. So be taking notes on how you feel with your son, because that warmth and that affection that you feel with your daughters might not always be there during their later adolescent years.
Jennifer, thanks. You were a great call, and make sure you get a copy of Connecting Faith, the home version, the home game. Thanks for calling. Doug, let's talk a little bit more about encouraging words, because sometimes dads think they got the good words, but they really don't, because they say stuff like, don't cry, shake it off, you'll be fine, just put some ice on it. And all the while, the kid needs something a little bit more, a little more comforting, so they feel a little alienated.
Yeah.
And they might fire back going, well, gosh, affection wasn't modeled to me. It's not my personality to be touchy-feely. I'm reading this all out of your book, by the way. I was abused as a child, so I struggle with this whole subject. So we've got lots of excuses for what's going on. Talk about that parent that might not be giving the child exactly what they need because they didn't have it themselves.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, you mentioned the dad part, and that is, you know, I always say that's why never in the recorded history of the world has a child hurt himself or herself out front and ran into the house yelling for dad. You know, they just don't do that because, you know, I always say dads don't care, you know, and of course they do. But, you know, my dad, he had a set of skills that he picked up from his dad. And that dad had a set of skills that he picked up from his dad. And so, you know, there's this generational parenting that, you know, I think, you know, people listening and people sitting willing to go through the intentional parenting content, you know, we actually have the opportunity to be a transitional generation of parents who actually learn that yelling doesn't work, that learn that, you know, affection is needed and okay, that learns that I've got to face some of the stuff in my past and work through that and deal with that. And if I don't, I'm actually going to pass that on to my children, and they're just going to, you know, it's the cats in the cradle. They're going to look just like you, Dad. You know they're going to be like you. So I'm pretty sensitive to people who have painful pasts and say, you know, I'm not affectionate because it wasn't modeled, or I had abuse in my background or something like that. And I am so sorry that has been your experience. But at some point, we all have hurdles to be good parents. We have hurdles to be good human beings. And so we have to figure out what those hurdles are. We have to face those hurdles and figure it out. Or again, as I mentioned earlier, you know, our kids are going to wind up paying for the therapy that we should have paid for.
Yeah. Doug, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to talk about the sacrifices intentional parents make and how they have to be consistently present. That should make everyone nervous. So lots more coming up with Doug Fields. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Bill Arnold in for Neil Staben. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. We're talking about intentional parenting today with Doug Fields. He's written a book that we're talking about today called Intentional Parenting, 10 Ways to Be an Exceptional Parent in a Quick Fix World. Doug, one of the things that you talk about in your book is being consistent and being present consistently. Now, I think part of that feels a function of this generation. When I was growing up, and I think you and I are the similar vintage, in my world, the baseball schedule was on the refrigerator, and I was told that I had a game at 2, and I got on my bike and went and played baseball and came home. That was it. Kids had sports and activities, and it's what they did. And now there seems like parents are at the practices, and there are so much programmed things that parents would be are exhausted from all the activities.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what Kathy and I are saying, when we talk about one of the actions that make up an intentional parent, it's consistent present, not constant present.
Okay.
So I try to make a difference to relieve some of the guilt of, you know, I know there's some single parents who are listening who are heroic in how they pull it off and try to juggle everything and provide for the, you know, family as a single parent. So I don't want to add any guilt to their plate, because I really believe that those kids are going to rise up and call that mom blessed someday, although she couldn't be at everything.
Right.
I think what isn't as attractive to kids is the mom or the dad who was overworking, not to support their kids' habits, but to support their own ego and to, you know, drive the nicer car, live in the better neighborhood, and then never showed up to any of their kids' stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think parents understand that your presence at a kid's something significant to them is memorable. You know, let's go back to that same Little League baseball game, Bill. You know, I know for me, my dad worked 9 to 5. He was an accountant, and so he couldn't, you know, in that era, he couldn't leave the office early to go to my games.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom never missed.
Cool.
And so, you know, I remember her being in the bleachers, because the bleachers were not that far from the bench that I was sitting on. And so we could actually have conversations back and forth. But
some quality time,
you know,
with
that's
mom.
Kind of the idea with presence.
Yeah.
That it doesn't have to be constant, but we you know, parenting is sacrifice. You know, Ted would probably amen that you're sacrificing sleep, you're sacrificing where you want to eat. I mean, parenting is a constant sacrifice. When when my daughter was in high school, I can remember going to, you know, one of her freshman girls' basketball games, and she had a best friend named Sarah, and I'm like, Sarah, I know you, you have a mom and your dad, but I have never seen your dad at any basketball games. And Sarah said to me, "Well, Mr. Fields, my dad doesn't like girls' basketball."
Ooh, ouch.
And I thought to myself, well, first, no one likes girls' basketball. I mean, that's, come on. I don't know, Bill, if you've ever seen a freshman girls' basketball.
I haven't.
The final score is 3-2. I mean, I don't know if there will be sports in hell, but if there is, it'll be girls' basketball. But, you know, my point is, look, you don't go to a freshman girls basketball game for athletic enjoyment. You go to be there for your daughter and to cheer her on and to say, you know, I love you, whether you're playing or whether you're sitting on the bench. So that's a sacrifice, and that's what presence is. And I think, you know, spiritually speaking, I think presence is kind of built into the DNA of who we are. I mean, if you think about, you know, God's presence created this whole playground that we call Earth. God became more present to us in Jesus. When Jesus ascended, he left us his Holy Spirit to be present. I mean, presence is big. And it goes back to the first thing we talked about, that strong belief, that believing that I'm the most influential person in the life of my child. I don't need to be at every practice they're at. I don't need to carry their cleats to the baseball field for them. But I need to show them that their world matters to me, because presence says you matter.
Mm-hmm. Our friend Bob Stromberg, who is a very successful entertainer, it was his kids went to school and they were asked, "What does your dad do for a living?" And they said, "Well, we're not sure. We just know when we come home from school, he's waiting at the door for us."
That's great.
Yeah.
That is great.
And his kids are both in jail right now, too, as well.
Yeah, not real sharp kids.
No, they're not very bright. They're not very bright.
Yeah.
Let's talk about creating a shelter from the storm. Intentional parents are going to have a home that has creates a shelter, right?
Yeah. Kathy and I refer to this as a peaceful home. And kind of the big idea here is that, you know, kids, you can't have a peaceful home until you have a peaceful heart. So it goes back to what we talked about earlier, that as parents, we kind of have to hold up the mirror a little bit to say, okay, what's broken in me that I'm always causing chaos? And I think kids today, they're, you know, we hear a lot in media about bullying and peer pressure and all this stuff that, you know, a peaceful home is what I would call a safe home, meaning they're safe from judgment, safe from, you know, being yelled at. They're safe from, you know, they can be themselves. They don't have to put on a mask. They don't have to pretend. So peaceful home is not just you have white music playing and there's no trash on the floor. I'm not referring to that. Kathy and I kind of had this idea that, you know, when our kids came home after being kind of out in the world for as many hours as they were, that the image we had is they would kind of come through the door, slam the door, lean up against the door, and kind of slide down it with that, you know, gasp, like, I'm home.
Mm-hmm.
That never happened, but that was kind of the idea that we had is like, you know, we want our home to be a peaceful home, meaning meaning that they could be who they were, they could be safe, they weren't going to experience the same pressure and tension that they were experiencing in the world. And I go back to saying, you know, I don't think you can have a peaceful home until you have a peaceful heart. And so, again, it points back to us as parents. What does it look like for us to create a peaceful home?
Yeah, Doug, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to talk about activating responsibility. The kids come home, and the other person's always wrong, the teacher's dumb, the coach is stupid.
Yeah.
How do you deal? How do you get kids involved and responsible?
Yeah, that's a great question because people will say things like, you know, hey, why is it that, you know, today's world, kids are so irresponsible, as if it's their fault. And so my point on this, Bill, is that responsibility is not genetic. So you're not born with a sense of responsibility. And so responsibility means that as adults, one of our roles is we've got to teach them what it means to be responsible. That's where consequence comes into play. That's where chores, you know, you go back even 50 years. If a child did not contribute to the family, oftentimes in a, you know, agricultural area where, you know, some of you, your audience is from, you know, if they didn't contribute on the farm, if they didn't milk the cows, if they, you know, they wouldn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, today's kids are not even needed in order for mom and dad to provide food, you know, which is, you know, why they're called a deduction. But they, you know, they're not given, I've got my, when my son was in high school, his buddies would spend the night and they would ask me, hey, Mr. Fields, can you wake us up tomorrow to go to practice? I'm like, are you kidding me? No, I'm not going to wake you up in the morning. But they were 17, 18 years old, and their parents, you know, woke them up and did things for them and carried their equipment from the car to the game. You know, all this stuff that seems like, oh, I'm just being a good parent. Well, in many ways, you know, we wonder now why, fast forward the clock a little bit, why are the average marriage gone from 22 to 28 years old? Why is it that if you Googled extended adolescence, you see that adolescence goes into its late 20s now rather than to its late teens, is because we've protected kids from growing up. We've helicoptered around them. We've saved them from everything. Every time, you know, they forgot their lunch, mom ran it to the school because the mom didn't want their child to starve to death. You know, all of these things, they create for, I think, in our culture, they create kids who it's never their fault.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they blame others, the dumb teacher, the stupid coach, the lame parent. They're apathetic. They kind of have the, what I call a care for me mentality. I don't need to worry about it because somebody will care for me. So all this to say, to activate responsibility as early as you can, we encourage parents to institute chores.
Yeah.
Because chores and consequences of chores, actually, when kids have consequences, one, it helps them become more responsible. Two, it actually builds their self-esteem. So a kid, if I know that I'm going to have a consequence if I behave a certain way, it actually tells me that I'm not a victim, that I have power over my choices. And that's a very important thing for a child to learn in today's culture, that I don't have to be a victim.
Yeah, Doug, this has really been a fast hour. I thought the whole thing was going to drag, but it didn't. It went really fast. But
well,
this
that's
has been
good.
Well, I'd love to have you back on if I still have the job. The website is www.dougfields.com. You can get more information about Doug. And the book is called Intentional Parenting, 10 Ways to Be an Exceptional Parent in a Quick Fix World. That is all the time we have, Doug. So thanks so much for taking your time on this beautiful Southern California day that you're having to join us.
That's great. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it. And I hope you guys get your elk problem solved.
Yeah, thanks. I'll talk to you later. That wraps up today's Connecting Faith. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.